Well, what do you say, you guys, WJR family? It's been a minute. Happy to be here, sitting in for Paul. I just got a message from Paul. Little go get him, Tiger type of text. I love that from him. Quite a bit going on in the world. Mike Parsons, Danielle Mason, how we doing?
Good, Chris. And yeah, there's never any shortage of things to talk about. Actually, when we have you fill in, you usually have a couple months pent up of things you want to get off your chest. So I'm sure today's show will be a good one.
I don't know about pent up trying to get it off my chest, but I feel like we're a tad overdue. I know I've said no to quite a few requests as a fill-in. We're very busy this season, which is actually kind of unusual. Usually in my world, in the retirement planning, financial planning world, this is one of the softer pockets of time because oftentimes, people have grandkids getting out of school or whatever the season demands, and maybe the snowbirds have come back, that kind of thing. But it tends to be a little bit slower this time of year. We expanded a little bit on my side of the fence for my team. So we've been advertising a little bit more, taking on more clients than perhaps we had in previous years. So it's been busy around here, but it's awfully nice to kind of block this off and get behind the mic. I don't want to spend a ton of time on Trump. Couple things, kind of pop up that I think are fascinating. We're going to talk about the Pride survey in terms of, are you proud to be an American? Jared Halpern will join. I want to talk a little bit about Pride Month, without ticking the wrong people off. I think it's worth discussing. Like, is this kind of thing observance-wise really worthwhile? Talk a little bit about how the crazy side of the Democrat Party is starting to work, and is that really going to backfire on them? Not that there's not crazy on the right, but I feel like the left's gotten a little crazier lately, and potentially they're kind of screwing it up for the next time around, but that's just my feeling. Although Mike Parsons, I got to have a pretty darn good record with predictions in the last 4 or 5 years, don't I?
Yeah. If you say... I feel like I owe you like 7 dinners because you'd say, oh, this is going to happen. And I said, there's no way. And you say, I bet you dinner. And so I think I probably could feed you and your family for a month with all the predictions that have come true.
I got 5 kids and they love to eat. I'm not sure you would want to do that. This is how old I'm getting, by the way, you guys. And for all the listeners out there, at 49 this year, I have my oldest daughter getting married in about 2 weeks. And I just dropped off my 5-year-old Jolene at Vacation Bible School this morning. Wow. How is that for variety?
I was going to say, it's got to be exhausting on the younger end and expensive on the older end.
I know. I'll probably be the first.
Oh, and we'll get Chris back on with us very soon, but. Yeah, we got a great show coming up. Also, we're going to be talking about Tarion Arnold and all of a sudden the charges that he was facing a couple months ago, I think back in February, where it sounded like his legal team was just trying to make it sound like he was just sort of there and along for the ride. Well, now it turns out that Tarion Arnold is being charged with planning an armed robbery and an assault on somebody who he thought was stealing from him, over $250,000. That's crazy, Chris.
Yeah, sorry. With the internet glitch, perhaps the thunderstorm over here has an effect on that. So I'm back. What were we just talking about?
You were talking about how expensive you've got a daughter getting married week, and you just dropped your 5-year-old off at school.
Right. I know it's quite the spread in terms of age. That's when prospective clients come in here and they say, listen, it's a very nice business. Are you going to retire anytime soon? I said, well, why in the heck would I retire? This is the only place I have any peace and quiet is coming to the office.
Right.
We're doing radio. Right. So I don't know what you got into there where I was missing an action for about 30 seconds.
I was previewing the Tarion Arnold topic.
Oh, good grief. I know. I mean,
so does that mean he's not going to be at training camp? I'm guessing we can rule him out for training camp.
There is no chance. We're going to talk to Bellino, I think, in the second hour, the other AB. I'll explain that joke later. I don't understand, frankly, what's wrong with these guys, but we'll get into it later. But there's no way in the world the Detroit Lions, after making the kind of... let's call it equity progress in terms of a viable team in the league that's well respected, that players want to come to, they're going to cut him loose. I mean, I bet you dinner.
Well, no, because I believe you.
By the end of the week, he's gone, because there's no chance something like that will take the better part of a year to adjudicate. And they're not just going to sit there paying him a salary or having him on stay when they need someone in the secondary.
Well,
Brad Holmes is bald for a reason.
Right. Well, and here's the thing, too. I mean, you know, people, you and I were talking about this earlier, Chris, and everyone's like, yeah, you know, the Lions need to address this position group, this position group. We have addressed those position groups. Just everyone's getting injured or they're getting arrested. And $250,000, yeah, that's a lot of money. But now Terrion Arnold has lost, you know, tens of millions of dollars over this stupid decision.
He's cooked. And listen, I get fooled sometimes. I think we all do, by somebody with a, you know, Terrion Arnold, a handsome kid, great big smile, super articulate, has a compelling life story, working with his grandpa on the roof. You know, as a roofer, shingling as a young guy, learning the value of hard work. It's a pretty intoxicating story in terms of, look at this kid who's come up. This is straight out of the other side of the gangster booklet material, where you're arranging a kidnapping and pistol whipping people and so on and so forth. It's really sad, because I mean, clearly the guy had a runway to not only be a very, very good player, but seemed by every possible measure to be a really upstanding, fun, positive leaning young guy. And now we find out essentially the opposite. And not that people are, you know, without the possibility of redemption, but what a mess.
Yeah. And you also kind of wonder who he's hanging around with. Were they kind of egging him on and saying, hey man, you've changed? I know that, you know, we hear story after story of either athletes kind of leaving their old life behind so they avoid stuff like this. Or, you know, they're still hanging out with some people that they shouldn't anymore, and they end up blowing it like Terrion Arnold did.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, we don't know the depth of the story yet. I mean, there may be something more to it, but it's looked all along like it would be nearly impossible for him not to have some influence over the situation. Look, the Trump Iran thing, I mean, we got a couple minutes, I think, until we go to break, and I want to get over to Jared. The Trump Iran thing, I don't want to do. I mean, I'm sure everyone's been hearing it pretty much nonstop. You know, it's on, it's off. It's on, it's off.
Right.
They committed to this. No, they didn't. We committed to this. Well, actually, we got to change the language. Then some bombs get dropped, some missiles get fired. By the way, now we have to start over again. The whole thing is kind of nonsensical, although it's probably healthy in the long run. It looks like just a circle jerk. But let's talk later in this hour, at a minimum, on the Trump conflict within the GOP. I mean, yelling matches happening on the floor. He wants the voter ID thing passed. He backed out of the housing bill. I think the missing conversation on the housing stuff and the affordability crisis is not what everyone's saying. I'll give you my take on it. But it sounds like we got to flip over. So let's take a quick break, and then we'll visit with Jared Halpern and find out how proud Americans really are to be Americans. All right, now. That's my best Matthew McConaughey. All right, all right, all right, Mike Parsons.
That's good. I thought he replaced you.
I know, but we basically look like twins, he and I. When I look in the mirror sometimes, I think I'm watching the Lincoln Lawyer or something.
Same hair.
How proud are you to be an American? This is like one of those ongoing, every year we come around to this type of debates. It's really interesting for phone calls, too. And we'll open up the lines after if you want to get your digits ready. 800-859-0957, 859-0WJR. Jared Halpern joins because, again, now, of course, these massive polls, Fox News polls specifically. How proud are you to be an American? And it's a fascinating topic. Jared, thanks for joining, my friend.
Thanks.
So what's the rub? Is it any different than it was last year or the year before? Are we getting less proud of ourselves as we go on?
I don't think so. I think what often you see in these types of polls are some partisan divides. That's one of the things that certainly has stood out in a lot of the polling, not just Fox polling, but other polling about kind of how people feel about the 250th anniversary. And the biggest divide is kind of on optimism and whether or not the best days of the country are behind us. Voters split on whether the U.S. has made progress towards achieving its founding ideals. 17% say that's excellent. 23% say poor, and then everybody else says it's kind of good or only fair. And as I said, there is a little bit of a change in kind of how proud people are based on the party divide. Right now, as we talk, there are more Americans who say that they are, yes, proud to be an American than not. But that it has certainly shrunk over the last year or so. More than half votes over 45, so they are proud of the country. Those under 30 are the age group that are least proud, they say, of the country. So there is not just a political divide, but a generational split as well.
And Jared, there's no follow-up in terms of rationale, like why are you, because if you're not proud, potentially you're ashamed of the country. And depending on how far is broken down, I mean, you mentioned obviously party divide, there's some age bracketing. Is there anything else in terms of geographical breakdown, racial breakdown, anything like that?
Not really geographical. As I said, kind of the big divides are age, the generation, and kind of where you consider yourself on the political spectrum. You know, this poll asked people to, in just a couple of words, describe what it means to be an American. And the top answers were freedom and liberty, and national pride and patriotism kind of led that. And so I still think that, you know, a majority of Americans are proud of the country. And the split kind of is on how they view it through kind of a policy lens, whether or not the U.S. is living up to the founders' vision of what they had for this country.
Yeah, which is also interesting, right? I mean, as the years go on and academia gets more and more involved in, I wouldn't say revision because I think that's too subjective, but certainly casting a certain lens against what the founders really intended, which is open to interpretation, the younger generations, you know, clearly see that there's been failures more so than someone from the greatest generation, perhaps. Is there just two age brackets, like over 45 and under 45?
I think so.
I know you kind of jumped into this late, so I don't want to put
it on
the spot.
I didn't look at the cross tab. Sorry about that.
Well, that's okay. The topic is interesting regardless, I think. And we appreciate you joining the program, Jared. And I think as we get into this, Mike Parsons, let's make sure that we kind of paint this picture correctly. Is that fair? Can you be my advocate here in this dialogue?
Oh, yeah, let's rock and roll.
Oh, let's rock and roll. All right, cool. So, I mean, would you agree with me that younger people on average feel less proud of the country because they've been told of the great many sins of the country, regardless of the legitimacy of those claims?
Yeah, and I also think that when kids are younger, the picture is painted that, I think there's a very rosy picture painted for kids when they're younger. And then once they start, going up through the different grades and everything, I think it becomes quite a big shock about these sins of the past that you're talking about.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah, and I think that we're all a victim to this to some degree. I mean, the very rudimentary part of the history of the U.S., right? Fleeing, for example, England for things like the pursuit of freedom of religion and freedom of expression and freedom of language is a far cry from now what we look at as the founders' perhaps intentions. Anecdotally, I don't know, have you seen any of the kind of YouTube type experiences and memoirs of people who are over here watching the World Cup of soccer from other countries?
Yeah, we've been talking about it a lot, and it's nice to be reminded of the perks of living here in the United States.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I actually stumbled across a while ago, and I won't dwell on this, but there's a couple from the UK, kind of a muscular looking guy, a bodybuilder type, and a really pretty gal, blonde gal. And it was her lifelong dream to come to America and rent an RV, I mean, which is like the most, old school way to go see the country. And it basically turned into a phenomenally popular YouTube channel because they're going to every state. And I mean, they eat everything under the sun. I mean, they're going to Bucky's and gorging themselves in the Grand Canyon and Memphis, Tennessee and New York City and you name it. But the overarching theme in almost all of it is you people don't know how lucky you have it. Like, you have super speed highways, you have food at every place, you have smiling people who are largely welcoming, you have a lot of sunshine, you have incredible geography and landscape, you have rules that are permissible. The UK is basically turning into the European version of Cuba the last handful of years. I mean, people are going to jail over there for saying the wrong thing. So it's an odd reminder, especially in that demographic. I would imagine those people are in their early 30s, if I had to guess, that much of what we see as this kind of oppressive, weird undertone of America does all these things because they're a great big bully and we have so many sins. They forget about the incredibly sinful, let's call it, nature of the past of all of these other countries who, in many cases, have not evolved out of that. And in some cases, like the UK, are reverting back into it. Like, if young people who idealize like going to live in Norway, they have no idea what they're talking about. I mean, there's people in Norway who love to live here. They just can't get in.
I also think, you know, and here's the thing, too. I also think it's possible to not be proud of some of the things that our country has done in the past, both here and abroad, but still love the country and still be proud to be from it overall. Like, just like I think, you know, when people criticize the country, you know, a lot of people are criticizing it because they love the place and they think that it could be better. So, you know, I think two things can be true at one time.
Sure. I mean, if your dad ever said to you or your mom ever said to you, hey, listen, kid, I need you to live up to your potential. That's essentially what's being said.
Exactly.
In that kind of sentiment, right? But this would be an interesting one. And again, let's get the phones ready. 800-859-0957. Like, how proud are you to be an American based on the current status of America as your perception is of it to the world? What I would say, if you asked me to pick one or the other, are you lucky to be an American or are you proud to be an American? I think that if I'm being honest, and this will be unpopular, I would say I'm actually luckier to be an American. I was born here. I accomplished nothing. I didn't naturalize here. I didn't pass a test. I didn't come here as an immigrant settler and spend 20 years barely alive with no money trying to make it. I was lucky enough to be born here and have all these liberties. I am proud of what the country stands for, but I'm not sure that we always live up to it to the degree that we could. I think that's what you're trying to say. And I'd love to hear from listeners if they agree with me on that.
Yeah.
And on pride, we need to talk about Pride Month too, but what's your response?
I think you're right. That's how I feel too, because I don't know if pride is the word. I think if I did come here from another country, I put in the work, I did the classes and I passed the test. That'd be more pride, but yeah, it's more like we kind of won the lottery here, you know, being born where we were born.
Yeah, in many ways we did. We just don't perhaps appreciate it to the degree that we should. And really, pride is the key word here. And let's talk about that in a couple different angles when we return. Everyone hang tight, 800-859-0957. Pick up the phone. Give me your perspective. We'd love to hear it. Back in just a few. All right, hey, let's go here with the phones already. 800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR. How proud are you to be an American? I think we have lots to be proud of, and I think this is actually a great segue into some of these observance things, Mike Parsons. And, I mean, this could go on and on. I want to make sure that we include everyone when the phones do start to light up. But, I sent you a text the other day.
Mm-hmm.
About observance things. And I think this is fascinating because if you have young people that say, look, you know, there's the sins of this nation in terms of taking it from the Native Americans and in terms of, you know, having slaves shipped over here, almost entirely Black Americans, and you know, forcing them to the edges of society, and you can't vote and you work for me and I can rape the women and so on and so forth. That's a horrendous thing. But we're one of the only countries in almost all of these respects that ultimately got this right. Despite a progress that still continues, we, unlike many other nations who still fall victim to this, we changed it. And you got to remember that hundreds of thousands of people in some cases have died for the liberties of these people that we now observe. Check this out. On the calendar, February is Black History Month. It honors the contributions and history of Africans coming over to the Americas. I think that that's phenomenal. Is there something wrong with that? I mean, from Frederick Douglass to Harriet Tubman to Clarence Thomas. I mean, there should be a celebration there for these people, many of whom overcame tremendous hurdles
right.
and made massive contributions to the United States of America. I don't think anybody argues with that. They were born there. They ended up here. They are black-skinned by genetics, the way that God made them. And they're our brothers and sisters. Fabulous. All right, moving on. April. Celebrate Diversity Month. I don't know what that is. And Arab American Heritage Month. Now, to be fair, I didn't know that that was a thing. Did you, Arab American Heritage Month?
No, I actually learned a lot of these things existed from your text.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't either. It's not like they're focusing on that in school. Fine, so be it. There's plenty of Arab Americans that have made massive contributions. May is, a lot of listeners probably don't know this because I didn't. Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. Didn't know that was a thing. And Jewish American Heritage Month, that's May. June, we'll come back to June, but that is LGBTQ+ Pride Month. I'm not sure what we're supposed to be proud of there. That's more of a sexual behavior, a decision slash genetical predisposition than anything else. July is Disability Independence Day or Disability Pride Month. I think that one's really fascinating, and it doesn't get hardly that I've seen any real attention. There's a ton. I mean, there's millions and millions of Americans with disabilities. From an awareness standpoint, there's a key word in there, is awareness as opposed to pride. Right? Would I be proud if I had a disabled child? 100%. I'm proud of that child. I love that child. I want them to be recognized for their human value, not as Americans, but as human beings. They have the same human rights and should have the same civil rights. Is that fair?
Yes, completely fair.
And then we get into Women's Equality Day. Of course, way back in the beginning, I might have actually missed this. Women's History Month is March. That's phenomenal. By the way, in that same March, I've never heard of this one either. Makes me roll my eyes. It's alongside, it says Transgender Day of Visibility on March 31st. I feel bad for transgender people. We can come back to that too if you really want to get me in trouble. And then Women's Equality Day is in August. September 15 through October 15 is Hispanic Heritage Month, honoring Hispanics. Great. October is National Disability Employment Awareness Month and National Native American Heritage Month. Now, you would think, in the vein of modern academia, that the Native American stuff would be just as powerful, just as present, frankly, as Black History Month. Mm-hmm. And it's not. I mean, it certainly, you could make the case that is the tremendous injustice was done to Indigenous Native Americans. And some of that has been quelled, but not all of it. I mean, there's certainly some bitterness there. And there's, especially amongst young people, the idea that there was just this savage overtaking of these people and it was completely unjust. I'm not sure that that's really true, but it depends how subjective the history book wants to be, I suppose.
Yeah. So going back to Pride Month, I know you said that you had a little bit more to say about June.
Well, look, I just think it's getting to the silly point. And this is not a discussion where I want to then excoriate the country for observing this. Clinton came up with Pride Month in, I want to say, 99. And then Obama expanded it to LGBTQ+. Mm-hmm. Which probably was just LGBTQ back then in the 2000s. But the reason I think it's silly is because if you go way, way back, essentially what you're doing is you're saying, let's recognize that the period of time when the Stonewall riots happened, when cops were instructed to overtake these dive bars and enclaves of homosexuality and excoriate these people and persecute them and put them in jail, really for what is just sexual proclivity. It has nothing to do with ethnicity. It has everything to do with people who will tell you up and down and left and right, I was born being attracted to people of the same sex. And you do have to recognize, in my opinion, that when you live in a country that was designed, regardless of the predecessory element, where people will say, yeah, but we were designed by Christian-leaning founders and people who had biblical principles in mind when they wrote the Constitution. Like yeah, they did. But they wrote it specifically to not be something based in religiosity. So the fact that in America, you can have sex with whoever you want, so long as they're not a minor or an animal or whatever the case might be. This is one of the only areas where there was an element of shame. These people were made to feel ashamed of who they are. I remember, being a kid, now at almost 50, and when a celebrity or a ball player or something would quote unquote come out of the closet, that was the announcement of saying, look, I'm tired of being ashamed of who I am attracted to sexually. This is who I am, like it or lump it. And that went from a shock and awe type of headline to now being like, wow, how brave is so-and-so for coming out? Now, of course, it's a bit of a badge of honor. It's like you're more enlightened if you're anything other than a heterosexual person. So where I think it starts to get really, really silly is when there's implications because of this observance that corporations have to pay homage to this. I mean, you saw the baseball dispute with what was the San Francisco Giants. Mm-hmm. They made the players wear like these rainbow pride uniforms. And of course, one of the players who has a faith background writes a Bible scripture or something on his hat. I mean, I feel for that guy to some degree because he's being compelled by a corporation that's writing his paycheck to wear this thing that fundamentally goes against the religion that he's been brought up with and happens to believe. Is that really a fair position for anybody to be in? And more so, why does that baseball team need to compel people to wear pride outfits? Like, why are we proud of who you want to have sex with? It really doesn't make any sense whatsoever to me.
Yeah. So, yeah. And look, I'm not for forced compliance. I mean, I think people should be able to celebrate or not celebrate what they want. I don't. And this is coming from a straight guy who tries to be a friend to all. So, you know, I might, my perspective might not be the most accurate, but I don't know if Pride Month is the word. Maybe it's more like Safety Month. 'Cause it kind of started, like you said, with this after the Stonewall riots, and you know, it's for the people who might be afraid to come out or live their life in a genuine 100%. Way to say, look, there's a bunch of us out here. There's nothing wrong with it, and it's okay to love who you want.
Sure.
So that's kind of what I see the purpose of Pride Month being.
Well, I'd like to hear from the people on this, 800-859-0957. Has some of this gone too far? I mean, do the corporations or the businesses in the world need to be involved? Are we really calling it the right thing? I have no animus towards homosexual people whatsoever. I don't care. When I was a young guy, my mantra was the more gay guys there are, the more girls there are for me to try and date. I mean, it's just not that hard. It's a math proposition. Let's hear from you. As soon as we get back, 800-859-0957. Back into Jeff. So look, for all the hand-wringing we discussed, especially in younger age brackets about national pride, part of going through those observance things for women, for Black folks, for Arab Americans, so on and so forth, was to recognize that we, at least at the federal level, have acknowledged there's been a tremendous amount of contribution, a tremendous amount of evolution, and a tremendous amount of change in the cultural demographic that we all live in. And the Pride Month one is the stickiest one for me because it has nothing to do with ethnicity or background. It has a lot to do with, you know, the sexual predisposition, which is, I'm not sure that I know a lot of gay and lesbian people in my life, many of whom I get along with fabulously, and none of them are ever espousing how proud they are. If I held up a sign, Mike Parsons, that said, I'm so proud to be white, I would be in trouble. If I said, I'm so proud to be sexually attracted to women and not men, I would probably be in trouble. So I'm not sure why we do the reverse for an entire month and why corporations want to jump on board and jeopardize their own business only to make headlines then for distraction and for malfunction.
I think you might get support for a bald and beautiful sign, though. You might get some high fives.
Yeah!
You're right, Danielle's over there with a bunch of Sharpies right now making it, isn't he?
No, that's my thing. I call everyone a bib. That's how I hit on people at the bar.
What is a bib? What is that
supposed
to be?
Bald is beautiful.
Oh.
If there's some...
Listen, my favorite line is, God only made so many perfect heads, so I had to shave this one.
I've got a few texts here, Chris. I've got, pick your pride angle, Pride Month or pride in being an American. I've got them all.
Well, let's do the regular pride angle first, and then we'll go to American.
Okay, I got two of those. From the 248, they say, proud to be a first generation American. My grandparents and parents had to work for their sponsors to pay off their voyage. They worked hard and became Americanized in order to fit in during the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Those coming now do not seem to want to follow the American way, rather cultivating their own cultures. The melting pot is ready to boil over.
Ooh, that's such an interesting text. I mean, I think that, listen, here's my feedback right off, and I probably have to really digest this to give a fair analysis, but I mean, the beginning of it, I think, is spot on the money. The value has gone down in these American times, but one of the things that's very, very interesting is one of the most proud to me American demographics are the immigrants who have come from southern parts of America, Mexico, Guatemala, so on and so forth. Many of them have come here illegally in terms of passageway and spend years and years paying off cartels. And they're no less proud or no less hardworking to be Americans. We just have not created an efficient pathway for them. And instead, we've made this a national headline of trying to get rid of a lot of them. So, I mean, you can't have it both ways. I mean, I think that the beauty of the American immigrant path is one that we are welcoming all. We have plenty of room and there's plenty to do. And the other side of that is pretty nasty and ugly. But I think that the tenor of that is correct. I mean,
well, it's kind of like what you and I were saying, Chris, where, you know, we both love being American citizens, but you know, pride isn't as fitting as a word as lucky, because, you know, if we had to work to become citizens, there'd be more pride in that. We feel lucky because we were born here, and a lot of these rights and a lot of these privileges that people work so hard for, we just got because of where we were born.
Nail on the head, as usual, Mike Parsons. What's the next text?
This one is on Pride Month. This is Adam from Flushing. He said, the reason there's Gay Pride Month is because our friends and family, our gay friends and family still face injustice. Pride is a natural pushback against being unjustly shamed.
Okay. I don't know about unjustly. I mean, the shame part comes primarily from traditional biblical religious leaning people who feel that that kind of sexuality is immoral to them. They're taught that. They believe that. Many of them are warm-hearted towards the sin, which is really, really interesting, because on one hand, if you say, and this is where I think that modern Christianity is very, very flawed. If you say, for example, the Bible says very specifically that homosexuality is a sin, and you are outspoken about that, you are essentially shaming, albeit maybe not publicly shaming, but you're shaming homosexual people. At the same time, premarital sex and cohabitation is a sin. And a sin is a sin is a sin. You know how many Christian people I know who in their 50s and 60s who have children that are living with their girlfriends or boyfriends, and maybe they get married someday and maybe they don't?
Right.
I mean, they're not calling them out publicly. So I'm not sure what the differential is there. And I think as soon as you, I was telling my wife this yesterday, as soon as you start applying morality, especially faith-based morality, which is very subjective, to that particular equation, you miss the point of being an American.
100%. I mean, that's,
you have freedom of religion and expression, but you're not supposed then to utilize your belief schedule to disavow somebody else of their freedoms. You're free to sleep with whoever you want.
Right. I mean, if you get right down to it, that's a big reason a lot of people left England to come over here to escape being told what kind of religious beliefs they have to abide by.
Sure. And I think on that note, I mean, this is like I mentioned earlier, I feel bad for the transgender people. We have a couple by extension in our extended family. And this is one of those things that's really dicey. I don't want to get way into this. I have my fear for them is that most of them end up very, very lonely, because when you get into that enclave of people, if you're gay or lesbian, homosexual, you're already reducing your potential pool of mates by about 75%. All most people want in life is to be loved, to have significant physical, sexual, emotional connections with somebody else. That is success to most people interpersonally. But when you've reduced your pool by 75%, you're already kind of up a creek to a degree. But when you're in the trans community, which essentially is just gay with costumes in many ways, you're basically reducing it by 98%. Most of these people will be very, very sad down the line when they simply can't find someone to love and to feel like they appreciate them for who they are, because the pool of available mates is so incredibly small, and the depression rates and the suicidality rates are so on the moon. So aside from the politics, we have to have a heart for these people, because really they're headed for potentially an emotional disaster down the line. There's only so many of them out there. It's an interesting topic. All right, let's take a break. We're at the 50-yard line. Visit with Jason Rowe after the break. Let's talk a little bit about politics and all these elections that we keep on seeing ads for here in Michigan. Hang around. Ladies and gents, girls and boys, it's good to be back with you. We're at the 50-yard line. I was texting a good friend of ours last night, a good friend of the station's, Jason Rowe. I want to have a discussion about what I'm seeing at night. Maybe you are too. If you stream television or shows, as we often do, you're inundated now with these ads. This is the political warfare season as the more localized and state elections get underway. And as I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking some of these ads are so vague. And there's massive overtures against some of the candidates, not necessarily created by them. So, for example, Tom Barrett, who I like quite a bit as a human being. I've had him on the air several times. Jason Rowe, our good buddy, is a strategist that has worked with Tom for quite some time. I'm thinking to myself, if that ad is false, if it's just blatantly misleading, what levers do they have to pull to ask them to stop? Or do they mount their own campaign to say this is BS, this is not really how it went down, that kind of thing? And this goes across the board. So Jason Rowe, principal of Rowe Strategic, joins the program. Jay, thanks for coming on, pal.
Hey, my friend. Great to be with you again.
Likewise, if you're like me and you watch some of these, programming, and you see an ad pop up, and you just roll your eyes and go, "That's not even kind of true." I mean, do you call your guy or gal in the race and say, "Hey, you need to respond to this ASAP"? How does that work?
Well, first, I want to say how glad I am that you're getting those ads, because you live about 30 miles from the 7th District, which means these morons that are running the ads aren't even targeting voters in the 7th. So I don't want them to stop. Hopefully they're not listening. But there's not a lot of leverage that a candidate has to respond or to get false claims pulled from the air. On broadcast television, you can get it done. It usually takes getting your campaign attorney to write a letter to the station manager and documenting why the allegations are false. And I would say maybe 20-25% of the time that is successful. It really depends on that station manager's willingness, ethics, mm-hmm. nonpartisanship, et cetera, to make that kind of subjective decision. And when it comes to the candidates running those kinds of ads, the bar is even higher. But there's not much of a mechanism when you're looking at subscription services like YouTube, Hulu, et cetera, because those ads are not subject to the same FEC regulatory structure as broadcast television ads. And, for your listeners, when I say broadcast television, that's the four networks. That's the mm-hmm. broadest reach and the most expensive advertising and regulated by the FEC. So ads like what you're getting are targeted to you as an individual. So they have somewhere in their data a profile that includes you as a possibly persuadable voter on this messaging. And that's why you're getting right. that messaging. But when it comes to those services, it's kind of whack-a-mole. You would have to go to, YouTube itself and try to, I know how hard it is just to get someone on the phone regarding my subscription. Yeah, right. I can't imagine what it would be like to try to get them to consider pulling advertising that is being paid for. That's the other thing. You're asking right. them to take something down that they're profiting off of.
And some of these PAC foundations are very, very activist oriented, and they're not necessarily overly concerned about fact checking and the truth. If it's vague enough, for example, and it moves a specific group, they run it. In terms of, we'll use Tom Barrett because he's one of your guys as an example. I've seen two that have been inundated me recently. One is that he and Trump, and of course they have to throw Trump in there because they want to attach him to Trump at the hip in every possible way to get every, even in the middle Trump voter, to dislike Tom Barrett. But they basically shut all of the Planned Parenthoods down, and Planned Parenthoods in Michigan are integral to healthcare. The second, of course, is that he voted 100% of the time with Trump, which is not only kind of misleading. Tom has been very, very good at saying, "I represent the people of Michigan," and there's been plenty of times he disagreed with Trump, and Trump-loving people, MAGA people, were mad at Tom Barrett. So how do you tell him to respond? I mean, my mom always said, you catch more flies with honey than vinegar, but there's not a lot of honey in these things to begin with. How do you tell him then to shape these ads, or if the PACs come to you with an idea, what do you say?
Well, one thing is legally, we can't coordinate with those PACs. There is a firewall that prevents any kind of coordination. That would be a violation of federal campaign finance law. So we're prohibited. In fact, You know, the kinds of ads you're seeing, I was sitting in Tom's campaign headquarters back in 2024 in a group that was running ads on our behalf. They were running five consecutive times in a row and obviously wasting money and probably aggravating voters when they have to see the same ad over and over. So I called our campaign attorney and asked, is there any way I can notify this particular group that they're wasting money on these ads? And I am legally prohibited from even telling them that they're doing something wrong. Even if I didn't like the ads, it would be illegal for me to tell them to stop running an ad. So there's a lot of restrictions on that part of it. You know, for me, it really depends on what is a message that's persuadable for voters. I don't think an attack on Tom or any Republican about voting with Donald Trump is particularly effective. And the reason is it's already baked into the Republican brand at this point. People expect that a Republican is voting with Trump, for Trump, et cetera. So I don't know that it's a particularly persuadable message. It still, you know, requires campaigns to focus on the issues that voters actually care about. And, you know, you mentioned abortion, and that was most of the messaging for the Democrats in the last two election cycles. And Tom, I mean, I would say 50% of the spending against Tom was about abortion. And the National Republican Party wanted us to respond to those ads. And Tom and I talked several times and talked through. And here's the reality. Abortion affects 0.1 percentage point of the electorate, of the population. So there's, you know, the people that vote based on abortion are really liberal voters already. So, you know, us trying to mitigate that is dumb. We decided to ignore those attacks and to focus on inflation because inflation affects 100% of the voters. And so it really just, you look at your polling and you figure out what are the things that people care about. And we also differentiate because you can ask voters a question and they might give you something on what they like, but that doesn't mean it persuades them. I mean, I could ask you what color is your favorite color and you could tell me blue. And then I'd say, well, I'm going to paint your house blue. Well, you're not going to like that. So we try to focus on what are the issues that actually persuade a voter to vote a certain way, not just one that you're aligned with, you know, an opinion of some kind. And yeah. So there's a lot of nuance, obviously, to it. But we just try to focus on the things that actually voters are voting on and not just the kind of, you know, rhetoric that is as mindless as the Trump attacks.
Sure. Listen, we probably have 10 seconds to go in that vein then. As things progress and streaming becomes more popular in all these social media outlets, should those ads be somehow governed and fact checked before they're allowed to go?
That would be good. And I would love if the media did real and unbiased fact checking. Typically, they side with Democrats 90% of the time. It would be a constructive role and might actually draw some more eyeballs to their content.
All right. Love it. As always, Jason Rowe, terrific feedback. Interesting for us to learn as we watch all these ads nonstop. Okay, everybody, hang around. We're going to talk a little bit about what Starbucks is doing in the AI space versus human beings. You don't want to miss it. So many things in the works. Bad day for phone calls. I'm Mike Parsons. I don't know if I've done a show in years where we didn't have phone calls come in, except for the one time when the phones were down for a week, and it was like the longest week of broadcasting in my life.
Well,
but perhaps we'll squeak one in there at some point.
Yeah, we got to get people used to calling, but we've had some good texts. So,
listen, there's two things I want to mention, and then we're going to get to Anthony Bellino, talk a little bit of Detroit Lions stuff as we get into the early parts of the season. One is, I'm sure you've seen this, there's basically what they're calling the $1.6 billion bet. The idea is that Starbucks, of all companies, with 10,000 locations across the country, they've been running an experiment where they've hired or promoted from within what they're calling coffee house coaches. And the coffee house coaches are individuals who are doing, in many ways, the job in terms of oversight that the AI modules that they've contemplated using and they have been testing are doing. So essentially what they're saying is instead of having the baristas, for example, at the counter, relying on this AI software to hear literally audibly what the customer is saying they want and then put up the recipe in front of them and then potentially also solve problems with a complaint, so on and so forth. They're using these coffee house coaches to do that. They tried this at 62 locations. And they're saying that it works, and it works better, and customers appreciate it. And they've seen a slight uptick in profit and the efficiency speeds at which things are working. So what they're doing is they're adding 300 more coffee house coaches this month to expand that experiment, make sure the sample size, I imagine, is big enough and long enough. But this is really the first time we've seen a major American corporation say, hey, listen, we have indications that AI is going to start replacing some of these employees, but we'd rather pay the human being so long as it doesn't cost us money. Now, $1.6 billion, I looked it up, in essence, is about a one quarter's worth of total profit for Starbucks. So this is a risky experiment to do, but I think the positive spin there is that we're betting on human beings rather than trying to replace them.
Yeah, it sounds like they're trying to find the sweet spot between AI helping people and AI replacing people, because I think that's the two that's the two overwhelming feelings the public has towards AI.
Right.
We're like, oh, you know what? This has great potential to help us do our jobs. And then, oh, but it also could replace our jobs. So it sounds like I do like how Starbucks is putting a emphasis on human beings working and using AI as a tool and not a replacement.
Yeah, I do too. And I wonder, you know, because they're consumer facing, right? I mean, we're not talking about a giant software company or something that's entirely internal. You're facing human beings every single day that come in and they want their macchiato or their coffee or their bagel or all of the above. And there is a tremendous amount of efficiency that's required so that you don't stand in a line for 15 minutes or get the wrong drink. I mean, you're already paying probably more than that drink should ever cost, but it's a very, very successful corporation.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that they're already paying $30 to $40 an hour for many of these people at the more assistant manager type level to do this, that alone should tell you if they could replace that $40 an hour at the higher administrative level within the store with AI, they would in a heartbeat.
Absolutely.
But what they're making a bet on is that we can keep profit margins and efficiency the same or get better and not have to replace human beings. And I think that's a very interesting headline that's just not getting mentioned. So, I mean, for what it's worth, kind of a cool story. You have seen, I'm sure, as many folks have, how many elections lately have been lost, even by Democrats in some cities, to socialist candidates.
Yeah, I mean, especially New York. The other night, Mamdani went 3-0 with his primary-backed candidates.
Yeah, and this is, I think, a really interesting conversation. It's worth mentioning. I was trying to get Alyssa Slotkin to come on the program today. Their schedule's not conducive to that. But, I mean, one of the things that I wonder, I mean, if I was a Democratic strategist, I would be saying to the folks around me, hey, listen, are we getting entirely hijacked here by the Bernie Sanders, AOC, Mamdani types? Because if the we're not Trump has failed, in essence. I mean, you have a whole lot of people who, in the MAGA, let's call it enclave. I've used that word a lot today, enclave. In the MAGA, call it handful.
The wing.
They're going to vote for Trump anyway, right? And then you have this entire demographic of people somewhere in the middle who aren't really fond of Donald Trump, the man, but don't really mind the managerial prowess that he has had over many issues, and they are certainly not going to go to the extreme that some of the left has gone to on social issues. So essentially, one of the threats is, listen, if you're a Democrat, and Bill Maher has been saying this, you're going to have President J.D. Vance if you don't get off of the transgender rights train and the indoctrination of children and, you know, all the weird stuff that the really far left has gone to. So they're trying to say, listen, where's the moderate kind of, you know, middle of the road Democrat these days? But now that's been supplanted essentially because the most popular movement, the one that carries the most, especially in the youthful side of the electorate, the one that carries the most horsepower is selling the socialistic dream to people. And more people, more and more Democrats are getting elected as democratic socialists, or in Mamdani's case, really. I mean, there's more communism in his speeches than there is socialism, and no one can deny that if they're being fair. what is happening to the good old-fashioned Democrat that tends to lean left on social things? They want to argue a little bit more for the lower and middle class, so on and so forth. And then they go to battle with the old school Republicans, and you come up with a compromise. Have we lost that entirely? I mean, these people are selling a dream that is unlivable. It will never be accomplished in their lifetime.
Well, I think we're losing the middle. I actually kind of feel like this push towards socialism is kind of a reaction to how successful the MAGA movement has been, because the MAGA movement has been very successful. It's been loud. It's been boisterous. And I think for a while, Democrats tried to kind of fight it with sort of the old way of doing things. And they probably figure we've got to come up with a MAGA on our own on the other side of the aisle, you know, the complete other way of the pendulum. And I almost think that this is in response to how successful the Trump movement has been over the past 10 years.
Potentially. And I'm not saying you're wrong, but I mean, you could look at the Trump presidencies, and certainly while you could look at some failures and some things that are kind of feeble in terms of how you perceive the data, there's been plenty of successes that they could point to that are concrete, that they've already come in from economics to immigration standards changing, so on and so forth. Socialism in this New York City experiment, which is not indicative of what the federal landscape would look like, nothing that he's talking about being able to accomplish will be accomplished in his tenure there. It's literally impossible. So the dream that Bernie Sanders has been selling and espousing and mocking, despite the fact that he's a multi-millionaire, okay, is completely unaccomplishable, if that's a thing. So how did he, Bernie Sanders, become a kingmaker, and AOC become a kingmaker, and Mondami, who no one ever heard of until like 8 months ago, become a kingmaker? And what I would like to ask the modern Democrat who looks for some level of kind of like, this is feasible to do what we're trying to do, to bring things back towards the middle, lean left here, be in the middle here, so on and so forth. That's completely, completely eradicating the traditional plan, which is what most people are begging for. Like, hey, can we get some reasonable people back here just having a discussion, not screaming at each other about, you know, the most extreme versions of things?
Well, Rocky. And that's I mean, that's kind of the conundrum, because it seems like it seems like the loudest, you know, the loudest voices are on the far right or the far left. But everyone you talk to says that, you know, they want something a little bit more reasonable, a little more nuanced and towards the middle.
Yeah. And the affordability crisis, as it's called, often is a large reason for that. But I think that's also misperceived. All right. We got to roll over to an ad. We're going to talk football. On the other side of this, the Tyrion Arnold story is interesting, but the future of the Lions and the Pistons, for that matter, is interesting too. So everybody hang tight. Let's visit with good old AB when we get back. Hey, here's your chance to win a trip to see two country superstars, Jason Aldean and Luke Bryan, in Vegas. Double the hits, one unforgettable night. We've got your flights, got your hotel, concert tickets covered. The Double Down Tour, Aldean and Bryan co-headlining with special guests John Party and Chase Matthews, all live under the neon lights. Prizes are provided by BBR Music Group. Text this hour's Sky keyword boots to 95819. That's BOOTS to 95819. We'll text you back to confirm your entry. Data and messaging rates may apply. Please don't text and drive. Official rules and more are at WJR.com. Listen, we got a special guy on the line. We share a name, even though people don't realize this, AB. And we need to talk about sports. Anthony Bellino, host of Sports Wrap, the star, of course, of Sports Wrap, with that Lomas Brown guy. Who's that again? Weeknights at 6. AB, thanks for coming on, buddy.
Hey, Chris Alberta. You know, everybody's living by that 4% rule. I'm here for the 7% rule. How are you, my friend? Only free steak dinner is the one I want to go to with you, partner. What's happening?
Thank you, babe. Listen, you know why they call me AB? Did you ever hear this? I don't want to take our whole segment, but the hockey guys, it's the last name, right? No, because Alberta is Alberta, Canada, but like the three or four Canadian professional hockey guys that are retired now and I play golf with all the time, they call me AB for a couple of years, and I had no idea what it meant until someone said, "You idiot, it's Alberta." Yeah. And then when someone called you that at an event I was there with you, I said, "That's not my name. You can't use that name. I'm AB. I'm the real AB."
That makes total sense to me. That's the first thing I thought when you said that people call you that. I mean, yeah, Alberta, Canada. Of course. Why wouldn't people think of that? Go north of the border.
Listen, is Brad Holmes the unluckiest GM in the history of the NFL?
based on the 2024 draft class, yeah, and the fact that that was the one that was here in Detroit, and the only player that looks like he might actually work out of that is Christian Mahogany. I mean, he's the starting left guard, so you feel really good about his place, but he was the sixth-round draft pick. And then, you know, now with the news coming down last night that Terrion Arnold last night at 10:46 p.m. turned himself into county jail facing multiple felony accounts for kidnapping and assault here, and it's not looking good, and facing up to life in prison. That's the highest that these counts can go for. It's not looking good for that draft class. Now, prior to, you think about, okay, you've drafted Sam Laporta, you drafted Jahmyr Gibbs, you drafted Jack Campbell, those guys, and Brian Branch, all those guys came through in the same draft class. Now, Laporta, you know, he gets injured with a back. You have Brian Branch, who tears his Achilles. Kirby Joseph was a late, third-round pick. He's got a degenerative knee issue, so that's a problem. But Amon-Ra St. Brown, I mean, he was a fourth-round selection. That's turned out pretty well. So, you know, the draft is an imperfect science. I think overall, Brad's done a really, really good job. There were no signs of this type of behavior from Terrion Arnold. I think that's the most shocking thing here.
That's the understory, AB. What I find so fascinating is, like, the second most beautiful woman in the world besides my wife is Kay Adams. And I remember her doing an interview with Terrion Arnold after the draft. And you're this handsome young guy with a million-dollar smile, you know, spends 20 minutes talking about, you know, working as a roofer with his grandfather, who's his childhood hero in the Deep South, in this work ethic. And then he's a Christian, and he's got this whole faith-backed thing that he's working towards. He's busting his hump. He's a burgeoning star. Everyone sees his talent. When did he go from being hometown boy from Alabama, putting on roofs, happy to be a Detroit Lion, everyone's fond of this kid, to Al Capone? How in the world did they think at any point that he didn't have something to do with this plot, with his crew and his girlfriend, so on and so forth? The Lions will let him go within the next week because they can't afford to pay a salary and hang around and not replace him while this thing gets adjudicated. Am I wrong?
Yeah, I don't know what this does as far as the contract, and does it void it, right? I don't know how this whole thing plays out. Now, the charges are armed robbery and kidnapping that took place in retaliation to a pair of thefts that allegedly occurred at Arnold's rental home in Largo, Florida, and then they actually called to report the thefts of over somewhere between $200,000 and $250,000 worth of personal property belonging to Terrion and some of his friends. And then they called the police. The police, it turns out, they say that the people that were, you know, burglarized and beat up by Terrion's friends here, allegedly, those weren't even the right people that allegedly stole the goods in the first place. So you got the wrong people. And I don't understand, you know, the thieves allegedly stole high-end handbags, guns, jewelry, cash, a cell phone, you know, and at what point, as you mentioned, like, how is the first person that you're able to, you know, lock up is yourself? Like, what happens here? I mean, that's a corner. You're supposed to lock down the guy on the opposite team. It's not supposed to be, you know, you getting in trouble. When something like this happens, you call the police and you allow the police to do their job. You don't go vigilante justice like you're trying to play Grand Theft Auto out here and try to do this by yourself. You make too much money. You have way too much at stake to throw this all away. And it's exactly what Terrion's in the process of doing. However, he is innocent until proven guilty.
He is, but we know how this goes, and I like him. I really did like him and saw the upside. Martha's not going to stand for this. The Lions have built too much equity as an NFL team and a very desirable location, especially for young players to land in terms of development and coaching and infrastructure and culture, to have something like this attached to them. I think we all know how it's going to go. My Brad Holmes comment, Anthony, was really more of like, how unlucky can you get between injuries and arrests and everything else? His defense, that on paper is one of the best talented defenses, especially in the secondary and safety units, they've been just bludgeoned for the last 2.5 seasons. I mean, at some point, this stuff's got to stop if we want to win ball games.
Yeah, I mean, we might have to, like, sacrifice a goat or something. And you know, some people point to the training staff, and it's like, well, look at all these injuries. And it's like, I mean, Alex Anzalone broke a forearm. Carlton Davis broke his jaw. Every time I bring this up, I always forget the guy's name. And Khalil Dorsey broke his ankle. I mean, that happened, you know, 10 feet in front of me. And that was on friendly fire. You know, he ran into his own player. Aiden Hutchinson, when he broke his leg, right? We just can't seem, when it comes to the injury bug, it's not like it's a whole bunch of soft tissue stuff. You know, these are a lot of freak accidents that are happening. Yeah. It'll eventually. It will, I think, come together. I like this team a lot this year. The secondary is going to have questions. I think Rock Ya-Sin from last year at corner, that was a huge pickup. He played really, really well. you know, they're going to have to, you know, knock on his door once again. He, Roger McCreary, a guy that they picked up in the offseason, he is going to be leaned on. DJ Reed was really good last year for this club. And then at the safety position, they're going to have to get some serious minutes out of some guys where we're still, you know, Brian Branch isn't going to be available anytime soon. And Kirby Joseph, who knows what happens with the knee. So they've got some questions that they're going to have to answer here on the defensive side of the ball. But the best way to do that and to get help for the secondary is to get to the quarterback. I thought they did a good job of addressing the edge position to help out Aiden Hutchinson. They went with a couple of Michigan guys at defensive line and at linebacker. So I think all bodes well. They shored up the offensive line. The best way to keep the defense off the field is to have a really good offense. The offensive line will be improved. That will help out the defense by keeping them off the field. So I think things are still looking up, but man alive. I mean, this was a shocker.
Yeah, it's a stinky story. Sad for him and his family, sad for the institution, and sad for the fans. Anthony Bellino, the future greatest voice of Detroit sports, thanks for joining the program, buddy. We're running behind because of some of my iniquities as a radio host. Let's jump over the hats, and we'll be back real quick, and we'll talk with Ryan Armani. Thanks, everyone. Hang on. So we're at the 10-yard line on the very occasional fill-in of yours truly, the Bib, as I'm called by some in the studio there. I don't think Ryan Armani calls me Bib, though. I could be corrected. Ryan, do you know what a Bib
what,
is?
What is that? Bald is beautiful? Is that what it is?
I think you must have been listening.
I was listening earlier today when Danielle embraced the Bib, and I think that's fantastic.
I think it's fantastic that my fan club is like up to 7 between broadcasting and hairdo. Right? I'm pushing double digits here, man. I'm feeling pretty good about it.
Chris, you do an incredible job when you fill in. I really enjoy listening to you. You do fantastic.
Thanks, Paul. I'm going to put you and my mom, or Paul, Ryan, I'm going to put you
I've been
and my
called,
mom.
I've been called worse.
Have you, though? Okay, so listen, we had a discussion. I don't know if you heard any of it, but I mean, this national annual survey that comes out about American pride. And it's funny because Parsons and I were texting back and forth a couple days ago about Pride Month, right? The controversy around Pride Month with the baseball thing. There's always something with Pride Month. And I was juxtaposing that to how many observance type months we have. And I was actually patently unaware of many of them: Arab American Month, Pacific Islander Month, some of the women's things. And then you get into some of the more non-ethnicity-based, contribution-based things, some of which have to do purely with sexual preference, which I'm not sure that why we're, you know, under compulsion standards to recognize that. But he and I were talking about something interesting. If I were to ask you, if you had to choose between proud to be an American and lucky to be an American at your age and your stage of life right now, would you say that you were more lucky or more proud?
I would say obviously more proud. And I do think there's an element to being fortunate or feeling fortunate that you were born here. But at the same time, there is such a responsibility that comes along with being that. You know, yesterday on the show, Chris, I talked to, I forgot what the context of the conversation was, but we were talking about something in a legal immigrant came to this country. He called in and we were talking about progressivism and this progressive movement in the country, not only towards socialism, but essentially towards communism. The chief of staff for the mayor of New York, Zohran Mamdani, is literally saying, not hiding it, she says, we need more communists elected here in this country. And one of the gentlemen that called up yesterday did live in a communist country. And sure, somebody was in downtown Detroit over the years. And he tells the story, this legal immigrant that comes here and is so proud to be an American, tells this story. If that person really knows what it's like to live in a communist country, in everything that they did to be able to flee that communist country, and how blessed we are to be here and to have the ability to live free. It always feels like it's some college kid that is pushing communism,
sure,
right? This
that's the entirety of the argument, though, is based on relativism, right? I mean, that call's fascinating because we hear that over and over again, and you see the younger demographics lean into this. I'm kind of ashamed of the sins of our past as a country. And
a lot of that is college. A lot of that is college and privilege.
it's academia, right? And so that, I think that was why, like, if we were arguing this, you and I, over a beer, I would say, well, I'm on the lucky side because I didn't have to do what that guy did. I didn't have to live under those circumstances. I didn't have to naturalize. I didn't have to go through this journey, so to speak. So I'm not ashamed of my country. I'm very, very proud of what the country stands for, and know that despite the evolution and all the progress that's been made, there's more to have been done. But I feel overtly lucky that I was born here and have had the liberties since day one that many have not. And I think that's one of those missing elements.
Totally agree with that.
No one's telling these younger generations, like, hey, man, do you understand that you can't be gay in Pakistan? Do you understand that in communist countries, you are standing in bread lines and a job is assigned to you? Do you understand that socialism has failed the people of so many countries and they are desolately poor, sitting in the dirt?
I don't think they know, because one of the things they're learning at an early age is all of the faults of the country and not how we've evolved and gotten through and exceeded in so many ways, the beautiful parts of the country. They learn all the bad stuff, and I think you should learn the history of it so it doesn't repeat itself. But nonetheless, you don't learn about how great the country is in many ways. I think that's what's missing in academia. And also, as far as, you know, immigration goes, so many legal immigrants, just talk to them. Anybody that's a legal immigrant that fought to get to this country, they will tell you how beautiful it was to come to this country and assimilate to the country. And so many immigrants now, illegal immigrants, want you to change your ways, not the other way around. So it's a bigger conversation than 50 seconds. But Chris, we'll do this again sometime. Maybe you sit in with me one day and we'll just solve the world's problems.
I would love to have an immigration debate with you. I respect you immensely. And I just think, you know, your voice is addictive. It's great.
I really appreciate that.
All right, pal.
I'm going to put you and my mom on a group chat. And
two guys and two moms. That's our podcast.
Great job, Chris.
All right, pal. Appreciate it. Mike Parsons, Daniel Mason, thanks for having me in today. Paul, thanks for the nod. We'll see everybody soon.